and welcome. I'm Nina Serrano, and I'm joined today by Amelia Gonzalez, and we're here to bring you the most exciting literary voice in our area today, Jack Hirschman. He's just been appointed as Poet Laureate of San Francisco by Mayor Newsom. And we're going to be playing you some of his inaugural address, which was on April 4th of this year. And what was so exciting about it was that it wasn't just Jack's inauguration, it was a cultural victory for all of the people that stood for social justice, for an end to racism, for homes, for the homeless. I mean, Jack has been in the front lines of so many progressive movements in his many decades in the Bay Area. Jack is a combination, you might say, of the beat poets, except that the beat poets were beat, and Jack is a yes poet. A street poet, no doubt. But yet, as you're going to hear in just a moment, Jack has a background as a professor thrown out for supporting his students in their protests against the Vietnam War. So without further delay, I'm going to let you hear Jack tell you about his life, Jack Hirschman, on April 4th of 2006 at the San Francisco Public Library.
I'm honored to have been chosen by the committee of my poet peers and then definitively by Mayor Gavin Newsom to serve for the next 18 months as the Poet Laureate of the city of San Francisco. That honor bestowed has been especially heartening to me because in the many congratulations I've received from San Franciscans in every walk of life, I've sensed your sense of a cultural victory, not simply by way of my being recognized, but by way of your identification with many of the struggles I've been writing about here in the past 34 years. Of course, this small triumph comes amid an air of anomaly and absurdity, even where a poet laureateship is concerned. For we all are inescapably in a time of war, in which the human soul is devastated to degrees that are immeasurable. And somewhere in that devastation in each of us, there are heard the physical bleeding cries of brothers and sisters, young and old alike, and I mean Afghanis and Iraqis as well as Americans, whom our own barbaric and monstrous system of greed and our own Congress of murderous cowards have decided must continue to be sacrificed on the altar of profits and voids. I've said that I believe that everyone is a poet and that one of the central reasons that I fought as a revolutionary is to change not only the material conditions of mankind, but in so doing to liberate that idea that everyone is a poet into human consciousness. Why? Because the language is indeed the house of being, and its most concentrated expression is poetry, and poetry is the truth of being. And that truth, which I call the most powerful thing in human expression, is precisely so because it defies and deconstructs power, because its own power resides in its expression of the end of power through the verbal and rhythmic adventure of listening not only to what calls from within, but to the inwardness of material things and beings outwardly in motion, which not only live anew in their being named, but in their newness, in their being re-begun. For the truth of beginning is all that being is as well, also reveal to the poet their innermost secrets so that he might show the way to the light of the heart in the dark times of chaos and extreme psychic estrangement. What matters is that a child of six in one part of the city and a man of 65 in another part of the city, both of them sitting at a table or a desk writing poems, are embodying the essence of beginning and equality in a way that reduces all talk about beginning and equality to an exercise in rhetoric. Each is writing a poem. In the act of feeling, whatever the content of each one's poem, The two are equal in love, though they don't even know one another, and power is overthrown. A radiance therein is being suggested, and let it be a preamble to a brief resume of myself, including some poetry, so that you have an idea of who I am and what the grounds are for my standing before you. To begin, then, I love the sound of words. My earliest memory is of the combo of sounds India, rubber, ball, which I heard as India Rubber Ball, one word in a poem, The Shadow, by Robert Louis Stevenson, which my mother read to me when I was 3 or 4. That onomatopoeia was the beginning of my life as a poet. Then, when I was 12, I wrote and sang my first poem, a song poem, The Bells of Freedom, at the block party organized by my father to celebrate the end of World War II. When I was 15, I fell in love with a girl my age who carried a bilingual New Directions edition of the lyrical works of Paul Eluard, the great French poet. We read them together, and later it was she who led me, hallelujah for girls, young and old, to what I realized later still was, if not a communist, then certainly a progressive political meeting. I wanted to be a journalist like Hemingway, writing Spanish Civil War articles, dreaming of growing up to write a novel like For Whom the Bell Tolls. I'd already, in the 15th year of my life, been working for a weekly newspaper in the Bronx. Whammo, my first brush with the law. The paper was a front for a large bookmaking operation. Two guys in the other room worked a switchboard connected to a larger Yonkers daily newspaper, which in turn was plugged into the Yonkers Raceway. Busted at 16 by the Kefauver of the Crime Commission, which had come to New York to clean up crime, I was spared prison time because a last-minute deal, probably a payoff, canceled the hearing, but the newspaper was forced to close. A couple of years later, I passed from Hemingway to Joyce, thought I was Stephen Dedalus, and studied Latin and Greek, the keys to what translation abilities I have. I spent the next 11 years in Indiana, New Hampshire, and Southern California as a teacher in the universities. By then, Jack Kerouac had raised our eyes to the road, Lawrence Ferlinghetti to a poetry painted by the voice, and in 1956, Allen Ginsberg momentously enunciated the narco-imperialist nightmare. All wrote in new American idioms, born in the depths of jazz and African-American longing for a civil rights movement just emerging, along with a free speech movement. I was teaching, but writing poetry as well, and involved with the latest motions outside academic life, influenced by those idioms, but still rather Europhile in my taste and sensibility. With the Vietnam War, I did some things against the state with my students and was terminated at UCLA. I decided to turn my back on the corporation, that is, the academic institution, and I would never return to that life again. After my finish with academic life, I went to live in Venice. I went to live in Venice, California, where for 4 years I simply wrote poems, translated, and also painted. And that has been what I have done with all my life to this day, with the help of devoted and generous women in my life, all of whom have also been exceptionally creative people and brothers in and out of the arts who have sustained me in countless ways. Early in 1973, in San Francisco by then, after some weeks on Leavenworth Street, I made North Beach my village and lived first in the now defunct New Riviera Hotel, and then with the artist Kristen Vedahan in a flat on Kearney Street. The true history of North Beach in those years of the 70s and 80s is not written in words, but rather in the napkin portraits that Kristen drew. She can write a face better than anyone around. Faces of people visiting from other neighborhoods and other countries to the cafes of North Beach in that time of war and lunacy. With the Russian language, I wrote a poem a day in Russian for the next 11 years, as well as my own American language. I then fully entered a domain of international engagement, the other languages had already confirmed that, but Russian was a language in my mind, at least, of Mayakovsky, Lenin, the Bolshevik Revolution. Within the next 3 years, I'd become part of a cultural group preparing for the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua, working with Roberto Vargas, Alejandro Murguia, Jim Willems, and many other compañeros and compañeras opposed to the Somoza regime, which fell in 1979. The next year, I entered the Communist Labor Party, a small party in comparison with others, but one which I found amenable not only because of its principled and thorough analyses of matters in this country and Mexico, but because the CLP was open to poetry. I wasn't the only poet among its cadres. The Chicano poet Luis Rodriguez was among us, as well as African-American Michael Hall, the Japanese-American Kimiko Han, the Irish-American Frank Fury, and many others all contributed to the cultural dimension of the CLP's program. The CLP taught me compromise, not the compromise that means sell out, not the Hollywood happy ending when everything else in the film insists upon an ending that isn't faked and contrived, but the compromise demolishing the capital P for poet ego and leading one through the most beautiful coercion, a coercion of self-realization, to put one's deepest abilities at the services of the working class struggle for liberation from the yoke of capitalism. I, who had come from the, quote, lower middle class, end quote, like many writers and artists of my generation in New York City and elsewhere after World War II, found in the leap of identity with the poor workers, blacks, Latinos, the unemployed, the immigrants, where the energies of my poem contents really came from. And it was then I realized I was being called by another set of demands than the ones in which the poet writes for other poets, sees the avant-garde as a group of poets or artists. During the next years of the 80s, a number of events come to matter very, very importantly. For one, I met Shabba Palini, an artist and publisher of Left Curve magazine, with whom I have worked to this day. Originally born in Hungary and raised in Ohio, Shabba has worked pretty much all of his adult life to produce an annual issue of a magazine, also governed by strong principles, and he has fine instincts for publishing very socially and politically engaged articles and poetry. Ours has been a deep and rewarding fraternal relationship rooted in both Marxist and Heideggerian thought these many years. Shortly thereafter, the death of my son, David, at 25 of lymphoma, who was a jazz announcer in Santa Cruz, devastated my life. Until then, I believed that the most tragic event in American life had been the events of Jonestown, with the exception, of course, of 9-1-1. But in part, even including 9-1-1, I still believe that. Tragic in the sense that the effects are the most profoundly immeasurable. So too is the effects of my beloved son's passing. Nothing simplifies more deeply than does death. With the coming to power of Ronald Reagan, the left in this city had begun mobilizing against him. The left-right, spelled W-R-I-T, Conference of Poets, Writers, and Intellectuals, convened, and out of it was developed, among other things, a collective of translators of revolutionary poems from all over the world, with American poets being translated into other languages and the issues sent to 50 countries to revolutionary cadres or writers' unions. We worked in collaboration with Paul Larocque, who headed up the Association of Haitian Writers Abroad in New York. We published a poetry newsletter called Bumba Canoe, which included translations of Haitian poets written both in French and in the native Creole. We organized events to shed light on the cruelties of the baby Dr. Valier dictatorship in Haiti. Those were the days of many national liberation struggles, spurred on by the Sandinista victory in Nicaragua. Following a grouping in Mexico, Alejandro Murguia and Magali Fernandez called for the formation of the Roque Dalton Cultural Brigade, La Brigada Cultural de Roque Dalton, named after perhaps the finest poet of El Salvador. And our querida compañera Margaret Randall wrote the introduction. That book contains what I believe to be one of the most stirring and relevant poems written in the Americas since the end of World War II. Act in the name of those washing others' clothes, and cleansing others' filth and whiteness, in the name of those caring for others' kids and selling their labor power in the form of maternal love and humiliations, in the name of those living in another's house, which isn't even a kind belly but a tomb or a jail, in the name of those eating others' crumbs and chewing them still with the feeling of a thief, in the name of those living on others' land, the houses and factories and shops, streets, cities and towns, rivers, lakes, volcanoes and mountains always belong to others. And that's why the cops and the guards are there, guarding them against us. In the name of those who have nothing but hunger, exploitation, disease, a thirst for justice and water, persecutions and condemnations, loneliness, abandonment, oppression, and death. I accuse private property of depriving us of everything. My shorter poems, some of which you know, have heard here, have been recently collected in City Light's frontline editions of 50 Years of My Work, as well as in two chapbooks published by Sword Dove Press. Now the massive edition of Arcanes will be published in American in Italy next month, with introductions by Sergio Iaguli and David Meltzer, and a copious bibliography of all my works compiled by Matt Gonzalez, who many of you know, among other things, as a great friend of poets and artists of this city, and who made possible the most exciting and poetic political campaign in my lifetime and in the lifetime of many other San Franciscans. Before I close this address with a reading of one of the Arcanes, the one I publicly read 2 weeks ago at the large anti-war rally, and because your patience with this biographical tour of mine must have included a bit of impatience for me to get to what I'm going to do as the poet laureate, let me say this. Apart from my participation in the Lit Quake events on Valencia Street in October, which is part of the mandate for the laureate, and my continuing writing for and participation in events involving the issues of the day, especially they touch upon the material as well as the cultural needs of the people of San Francisco, I, along with others, will organize a giant 3-day festival to occur in the early months of next year. This festival will be international scope. Poets from other countries will be invited to join in readings with the best of San Francisco poets, by which I mean the most passionately and socially engaged voices. My own experience in the last few years has shown me that Youth Speaks contains some of the most exciting poets in the city, and so they will be represented, as will the best of hip-hop, whose form has sparked the greatest migration of poetry to other countries since the Beat years, and the best of, where I belong, the street poets of the city, and the poets of passionate deconstruction will be invited as well. I will also be working with Marcia Snyder and the staff here at the library to continue the excellent, inclusive work that the preceding poet laureate, Devorah Major, created, whose democratization of poetic presences from everywhere in the city I count truly stunning. Furthermore, I will call upon the soups of each of the 11 districts to put culture on their agenda by tapping their own districts and organizing, beginning with August and with my help, a monthly reading of poets living in said district, each month a different district. And these readings should include original languages and translation from the wide spectrum of languages in San Francisco: Chinese, Vietnamese, Arabic, Russian, Greek, Amharic, Yiddish, Hindi, Haitian, and Japanese, as well as courses French, Italian, Spanish, and German. For there are poets writing in other languages all over this town, and if you don't think so, let this be a call to them to come forward. Finally, and uniting with the suggestion of Gardner Haskell of the San Francisco Library, I will do all that's necessary to bring about the creation of Poets House in San Francisco. This will be a space for events, for a library, and will also contain within it and finally achieve a home for the poet Cush's Cloud House. One of the largest audio-visual collections of poets in the United States. Over the past more than 30 years, Cush's taped not only the poets of this city, but visiting poets from other places in the country and visiting poets from other countries on this planet. It's about time its work was given the honors it deserves, and the creation of Poets House, which will serve the whole city's cultural communities, will do just that. There's a poet, as we know, behind every espresso cup here in San Francisco. Many write in anonymity, even clandestinity. Yet everywhere, the human poetic soul knows how to deconstruct power. If I said the most important poet in the Americas for the past dozen years is a man named Raphael Guillen, most present here might not even know who I was talking about. But Guillen, a revolutionary poet and intellectual, at a certain point in his life found his cause among the indigenous poor, whom he has not only helped to organize, but from whom he has received some of the most profound poetic inspiration, and he has embodied, as a comrade has said of him, the idea of the word as a weapon deployed in the shadow of the gun, and led a major defiance against the evils of NAFTA and other corporate dislocations, using the poetic word as the finest example of manifest testament as well as political strategy. For that reason, I hold Subcomandante Marcos, his public name, in the highest regard, and hope in the coming period that voices for the new class of poor will emerge here in San Francisco with even greater fervor and hope, nourished by his example and that of the Mayan people of Chiapas. Let's open ourselves within to the truth of the real needs of our people, and let the winds of deep change blow through us, projected forward by the words and the voices of the poets who can make tomorrow die to become today. The Concero Sarcane. To throw a monkey wrench into the total mobilization of the empire machine, for those under a sun with its throat cut since birth, a sun born in chains that only shines at night, where dogs are eating dead bodies in the streets, and roots are captivity, and the simplest bread groans before it even enters a mouth, where revenge goes hand in hand with desolation to the school of suicide, enter this thickly carpeted chamber. Unbuckle your belt from around your religious waist. And with those who want to kill the killers, and those who want to kill those who have killed the killers, and with the shanda, the repeated shanda, and the ashes of memory, astonished that suddenly they themselves are sitting shiva in the wind blowing through everything, unbutton your blood down to your naked soul, bend over, drop to your knees. O tongue of oil between the violated thighs of Iraq, whose open mouth is Israel licking America's gun butt, while the pornophony of Palestine, gangbanged by all three, sounds through the wall the jism and saliva cries in twisted lascivia. Yes, it's all clear now, all here now are chosen, face down or eyes wide shut in the Razaya Yipele, or wide open as mouths around gun barrels, shooting bullets into every orifice in an orgy of lethal spunk. Oh, degenerate democracy, your uprooted waves of grass are the sea on which we cowed animals walk and bend and chew. But there's no rag for that 12-year period at the heart of your thirst for blood. So for those praying for the resistance, arming themselves for the resistance, gathering and committing their bodies to the death in resistance, we, who've never dug into earth to discover the roots of the suicide that's ticking in our ears every day, and who insist on values the rest of the bleeding world knows we've already thrown away. Exceptional America! America, the exception, now demanding to be the rule, and the ruler as well, come down on mankind's open palm, who beat off the Soviets in a 36-year masturbation, including the rape of Vietnam, the snuffing of Guatemala, the stacking of wads of dough on the night tables of Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Haiti to secure the brotherization of these days. Empire, we're the underworld of the world, led by a suited-up gang of mobsters, a lucre mad congress of cowards whose callous indifference and outpourings of bills for the passage of laws of extortion and trivia have ensured that it will take a man or woman all of his or her life to become a simple human being. Empire indeed, you giant indignity, you among us flop on the world stage. Only when, in just a few years, tough guy, that monster, to use your already warmongering name for her, will have overtaken you in every field of human endeavor and humanity, and that people both older and younger than you, a billion strong, will say, we don't want you to make war anymore anywhere on earth. If you do, we will stop you and your weapons of mass destruction without even a shot being fired. We're the majority. You're an unruly child. Go to the corner and learn your lesson. Then, America, finally, you'll be free. Yeah. Well.
The House of the Setting Sun. This has an epigraph written by Pier Paolo Pasolini in a poem called To the Red Flag. In Italian, the epigraph says, Ridivent un straccio, I più poveri ti sventoli, which translates, become a rag again, and the poorest may wave you. I put my mouth to your misery, New Orleans, inundated and soaking with death. Here lies, war lies, piled so high, this floating prison of a cemetery cries out of rage at the end of its breath. Here, in the last delta, desire lies on its side, is rolled and rolled over upon by its own government and crushed. Summertime is over and the living is dead, and round midnight all hopes are looted. No one will come clean of the Katrina of New Orleans in this sinking house of the setting sun. Bodies so black and so blue from loving what wouldn't spit on their shoes if they needed a shine, let alone a dime or water. America, you were always scorched earth in our mouths, always a baptism of crap, always a rain of disaster streaming down the panes of our broken eyes. Now our rags are the most torn, our jazz the most blue, our poor the poorest that can be worn in the soul's thrift shop. Now that all is lost and there's only nothing to lose, long live the courage and the sorrow and the innocence of the poor. The real flag's in tatters. Begin to wave it. Blue. Love comes over me like someone who walked away and left her white dress with a little blue flowers behind. Behind, going into the future radiantly naked. What am I to do with it? Put it on? I don't wear dresses. I love what's inside them. But this one's so sad and alone. I'll just let it lie a while on my chest, against the curve of my arm, and just let the blue flowers be blue. Mother, we are not in this world. A long time ago it happened. It was over the world, the world war. I took you by the hand through it, tiniest hand, tiniest star. You didn't move then. I was dead. Then you were dead. In the open mouth of grief, there is a candle. I am not with my breath. I am the slow peeling away of the skin and all the debts I've seen registers in my eyes. I have been a laughing tree beside a stove of honeyed bananas. I have been a silver fox in the elegance of heels. I have been what has brought you down and the words you look up. I have been the spit upon and the ganged, the slain and the invincible, the bitch of moons, the whiplash of compassion behind the drug of sluts, the red thread that liberates all convicts, the thimble that balances your jiggers, the kalimba that wraps your nightmares in lullabies, the power of birth when a child dies. We are not in this world. A long time ago it happened. It was over. The world war. I took you by the hand through it. Tiniest hand, tiniest star. Why should I weep now that you've entered the darkness? Many like me are around you. Our ether is without end. Should we never speak again, you shall write our conversation. Should my voice fall short of your heart, but that is impossible. You're still such a child. I'm weeping at a window. Other voices will lift mine and carry it to the center of your breathing. Oh, my beloved, when you burst into flames, when your bones were blistered, at those precise moments, who drove the seeds in a rapid torrent of thighs and targeted the yearning eggs with glory? When you grew like a primer into a text of rage at all the injustice of this profiteering hell, when your mind was broken, when your sex was split like Korea, Vietnam, like the North and South, when poisons came with pleasure and the antidote was dead. Who cut through the air as if wringing a chicken's neck? Who tore the feathers and flung them to cushion your fall? I am the creature who runs through the street screaming your name against the mockery. I am the sleep of the suicide and the cataract of the immemorial hair. I am the attack of liberty on the heart of heart, and the poem on the heart of hearing, the solitude, the grace, the smile that returns your smile from the depths of the biology of a labor and joy. Only the heartbeats of the dithyram approach, only the soul thrums of the cosmos define. We are not in this world. A long time ago it happened. It was over. The world war. I took you by the hand through it. Tiniest hand, tiniest star. All right, this is called Osei. Schools are closed. Art and music programs cut. But my mother didn't bring me up to be a goddamn gun butt. Oh, say, can you not see the school of the Americas shut? There are fish in the air when they open, ideas and beautiful doves fly up, but there are fists clenching bucks as payoffs for some of the roughest stuff going on from here to the shoe tip of Argentina. Oh, say, can you not see the school of the Americas shut? The Monroe Doctrine's not Marilyn, whom all kinds of people loved. It's a colonizing deal to keep military heels kicking in indigenous doors, clicking on indigenous floors, and it rewards such vultures by flying them north for seminars and training in murder and torture in the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. Oh, say, brothers and sisters, can you not see? Then they return to their native terra firma, Bolivia, Guatemala, and practice even more astutely the art of murder, the music of torture, to keep any resistance pissing in its pants, to crush the people's will and desire for liberty, and it's all thanks to the School of the Americas. But now, Venezuela's refused sending its guys north of Florida, and as Central and South America wise up to the empire's extortion and arrogance and defy the doctrine with socialism's common sense, others will play hooky from that cocky school of khaki ghouls. And oh, I can say, we will one day see that fool trap shut, the School of the Americas shut down.